coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Peace, y'all. This is Rod Stars.
This is G1. Together, we Rebel Diaz.
And when we out here in D.C., the DMV, we bump WPFW.
Washington.
Every Tuesday, 9 to 10 a.m., Voices with Vision. You heard? Understand. We've been trying to move this struggle from a lower to a higher level.
Voices with Vision, bringing you news and analysis.
It's about cutting-edge social justice issues by mixing various voices and ideas
with information, cultural expressions, and commentary.
Voices with Vision airs every Tuesday on your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW.
Good morning. It's March 5th, 2024. It's time for this week's edition of Voices with Vision. I'm Nefer Freeman in the virtual studio with Brother Craig, your co-host for this morning on that show that's not for the politically faint of heart. What's going on, Brother Craig?
Hey, what's happening, Nefer? And good morning to all of our listeners and podcast subscribers. Today is certainly a no-holds-bar show ahead. We'll get deep into it with two delegates of the second International Meeting of Theoretical Publications of Left Parties and Movements that took place last month in Havana, Cuba. Two guests who you might recognize have some very insightful things to say about it.
Before we get into that, a really good interview in store. We'll prime you with one of our audio mix collages that Voices with Vision is notorious for, getting into the genocide in Palestine, domestic U.S. repression, and media counterinsurgency, and what must be done.
For all our political prisoners and freedom fighters behind prison walls, what's the call?
Free them all.
Politics as defined by the geographical and influential spheres of this country is irrelevant to black people and is irrelevant to the masses of people. The vote has been used as a tool of oppression against black people. I mean, Camus raises a very good point when he says, what better way to enslave a man than give him the vote and call him free? See, it does not profit black people or poor people anything to have the vote and not be able to select the candidates that they want to choose. I think the vote can only be used as a tool of organization. We can only use the vote to organize our people. Now, to really believe that we can put someone in office and that these people would be responsive to our needs is naive, politically naive. Because even if one of the black candidates who ran for office were to take the office of president, then black people must be prepared to fight against that person. Because, you see, the system mandates the action of the individual. The individual does not determine how this country will function. This country works off the military-industrial complex, which means that it's profitable to wage war. And unless you devise another plan, another scheme to sustain, to boost this economy, then it's going to be necessary to wage war, whether, a black individual is in office or a white individual is in office. Well, so we're talking about a complete a change in system. I think there has to be a reevaluation of politics. Now, there are definitions of politics that are relevant to black people. Chairman Mao says that politics is war without bloodshed, and war is an extension of politics. I think black people have to begin to address themselves to the politics of revolution. So I think, black people have to begin to think in a revolutionary fashion and create and construct a politically revolutionary platform. I think, you know, like in terms of struggle and who will comprise the revolutionary front of that struggle, it will be oppressed people. You see, black people are in the vanguard position of the struggle because we've been the most dispossessed. However, there are other oppressed people in this country. Mexican American, the Spanish American community, the Puerto Ricans, American Indian, Japanese Americans, and even poor whites. But racism, I don't believe that racism will allow poor whites to form alliances with the revolutionary groups in this country. Now, in terms of black people occupying positions, America has created in Cleveland, Washington, D.C., and Gary, Indiana, a type of neo-colonialism. In other words, the man has set up a puppet regime. These black people, they are responsive to the needs and the whims of the Democratic Party and not of the masses of black people. I think news media and media in general are very negative in terms of any revolutionary movement or any movement that, you know, forces the change of the status quo. Now, media has always been an enemy of black people because what media has done is media has always singled out people who had vanguard positions or vanguard attitudes and tried to make these people an enemy of the masses of people. Malcolm X would be a good example. More Negroes feared Malcolm X than white people because news media told black people that Malcolm was bad. So the news media is a tool of oppression. We cannot rely upon white news media to convey black revolutionary messages.
Never let your enemy tell you how many of you there are. Never let the man that you're against form your opinion. This is the trick that's played on everyone who's oppressed. The first thing an occupation, when you have a revolution in the country, the first thing you take over is the radio. And then you start telling the people that everybody, the war is over. And so all of them surrender. No, they believe that thing right there. And once they take that over, they start telling you where you are and where they are, and you fall right in line. It's plain thought control. The majority of the American people aren't segregationists. That the majority of the American people aren't imperialists. But the government is, the structure is, the power faction is. So, how then do all the majority go along with it? Because those who sit in power over the television, over the radio, and over the press is constantly telling those who are the masses how free they are.
When the people who are in power want to use, again, create an image to justify something that's bad, they use the press. And they'll use the press to create a humanitarian image for a devil, or a devil image for a humanitarian. They'll take a person who's the victim of the crime and make it appear he's the criminal, and they'll take the criminal and make it appear that he's the victim of the crime. And the Congo situation is one of the best examples that I can cite right now to point this out. The Congo situation is a nasty example of how a country, because it is in power, can take its press and make the world accept something that's absolutely criminal. They take American trained, they take pilots that they say are American trained, and this automatically lends the respectability to them. And then they will call them anti-Cuban, anti-Castro Cubans, and that's supposed to add to their respectability. And eliminate the fact that they're dropping bombs on villages where they have no defense whatsoever against such planes, blowing to bits black women, Congolese children, Congolese babies. This is extremism. But it is never referred to as extremism because it is endorsed by the West. It's financed by America. It's made respectable by America. And that kind of extremism is never labeled as extremism because it's not extremism in defense of liberty. And if it is extremism in defense of liberty, as this talk has just pointed out, it's extremism in defense of liberty for the wrong type of people.
We have to see ourselves as the authors of a new justice. And wherever we find injustice and tyranny, we must stamp it. We must kill it. Frederick Douglass said the world belongs to the youth. Our job is to seize that and to make the world more humane. That has to be the role of any revolutionary or any person who considers himself revolutionary.
If we begin to examine the laws that have been coming out, you know, from Washington, D.C., and in terms of local governments, For the past 10 years, these have been laws of repression against black people, directed to black people. Omnibus crime bill, you know, as a new law that come out this summer called preventive detention law, the McCarran Act of 1950, which sets up concentration camps. All of these laws talks about dealing with black people. So I think that, you know, as that type of repression comes down, black people are going to be forced to do certain things. And in terms of, you know, revolutionary people, you see, white folks will create more revolutionary blacks than I ever could.
So I'll just finish up by saying, as a black man, I'm gonna wear this kufi until the day I die. And let me tell you why. Because growing up here in D.C. in the ninth grade, I was abused by police who were trained in Israel. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? And then in high school, my OG was put in prison using surveillance that was brought over here from Israel. My neighbor was shot down by police trained in Israel. Shame! In 2020, we witnessed a black man being suffocated out of existence by officers trained in Israel. Shame! And here in 2023, we're being forced to watch genocide live stream. Live stream. Shame! Done with our taxes and our so-called elected officials. Shame! And so to that we say, we ain't gone no more. So to me, I'm gonna ask you one last time. What's the most beautiful thing on the planet?
Solidarity!
That's it. Yeah. What's the most powerful weapon in the hands of the people?
Solidarity!
And how do we all get free?
Solidarity!
Solidarity, let's go.
Proper propaganda.
Watch it.
Yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Dilated, showing you where rhyme travel is. Worlds is spittoon, from sunlight to moon. Busting off stage like gunfights to moon. Pull my mic back, you like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander slash beat expander, here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show, get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines, wake up, refuse and resist. Like this, like this, like this, like this. We kick finance, action and scores of sports. Politics, new fashion and war reports. Entertainment, when we come to perform. Watch,
watch. The man in the biz, store watch.
Triclops Media, record tape or TV, net radio, CD or DVD. Ira Science. This is why Babu is in scratch and keeping time.
The whole liberation of oppressed people in the United States has to do not with climbing up some ladder to success, not for asking to be just like Rockefeller or just like DuPont or just like Ford, because that would only continue the oppression and exploitation of oppressed people in the United States, and specifically African people born and raised in the United States. Socialism is an integral part of building social justice on this planet. The condition of my people, my history, was very much connected with other oppressed people. And I began to see that the same foot that was on the necks of the Vietnamese people, that was on the necks of all oppressed people on the planet, was the same foot that was on my neck. And so I began to understand that imperialism has to go. It is a poison that is killing people all over this world. The priorities of this planet have to be completely changed. And instead of profits, instead of policies that destroy the earth, that destroy the water, that destroy human beings, I believe a policy that protects people, that makes people live in a community, a world community. That's what I believe. That's my basic political commitment.
This is why Babu is in scratch and keeping time.
My name is Asada Shakur, and I was born and raised in the United States. I am a descendant of Africans who were kidnapped and brought to the Americas as slaves. I spent my early childhood in the racist, segregated South. I later moved to the northern part of the country, where I realized that black people were equally victimized by racism and oppression. I grew up and became a political activist, participating in student struggles, the anti-war movement, and most of all, in the movement for the liberation of African Americans in the United States. I later joined the Black Panther Party, an organization that was targeted by the COINTELPRO program, a program that was set up by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to eliminate all political opposition to the U.S. government's policies, to destroy the Black liberation movement in the United States, to discredit activists, and to eliminate potential leaders. Under the COINTELPRO program, many political activists were harassed, imprisoned, murdered, or otherwise neutralized. As a result of being targeted by COINTELPRO, I, like many other young people, was faced with the threat of prison, underground, exile, or death. The FBI, with the help of local police agencies, systematically fed false accusations and fake news articles to the press, accusing me and other activists of crimes we did not commit. Although in my case, the charges were eventually dropped or I was eventually acquitted, the national and local police agencies created a situation where, based on their false accusations against me, any police officer could shoot me on sight. It was not until the Freedom of Information Act was passed in the mid-70s that we began to see the scope of the United States government's persecution of political activists. At this point, I think that it is important to make one thing very clear. I have advocated, and I still advocate, revolutionary changes in the structure and in the principles that govern the United States. I advocate self-determination for my people and for all oppressed people inside the United States. I advocate an end to capitalist exploitation, the abolition of racist policies, the eradication of sexism, and the elimination of political repression. If that is a crime, then I am totally guilty.
Glory, the pen is mightier than the sword, because the pen gives the word, sending swords to war. They twisted it when he quoted Mao Zedong and said political power comes from the barrel of a gun. The officer meet his fate by 44-38. It was a dirty deed, but that don't need a dirty case. Witnesses against the state, sure. Facts overlooked, so the judge could throw the book. Perhaps for politicians with something to prove. In the city where they blew the roof off a moon.
Yo, questions when answers lead to more questions.
Why'd it take months to remember a confession? Huh? The principles are saying even without the name. But I still say, M-U-M-I-A, I have to fight. It could easily be me. But just being the thinker that's speaking it freely. Although I use my brain before using a fist. Don't push it, wake up. Refuse and resist.
And as we just saw the other day, actually within the last month, we got two, I think it's been within the last month, The Guardian did that story recently about how Kwame Ture, who they would only refer to as Stokely Carmichael, not wanting to acknowledge his name change and his political evolution. But the article pointed out that the British state had been working with the West to surveil him, put him under surveillance, and to limit his ability specifically to spread the idea that black power meant socialism and Pan-Africanism. For those of us who study this history, that's not news, but I thought it was important to see that come out in The Guardian, specifically noting that it was his socialism and Pan-Africanism, the idea that black people in the United States were part of an African diaspora that needed to organize, unify for, specifically, as an Nkrumahist Tereist, for a United States of Africa under scientific socialism. So while Kwame Ture and others were redefining black power along those more appropriate lines, you of course had Nixon and the US state redefining openly black power as black capitalism and mainstream participation in black in electoral politics, and actively saying, as Nixon did, we don't want black power to be defined by the Kwame Ture's. We want to define it on our terms, which in today's United States is playing out perfectly, where power is identified often with business development and black capital. It's almost like a perfect success story from their point of view. But all of this was being built up and shaped, and particularly, again, from my own point of view and my interest is around the field of mass communication, again, and I said specifically, it developed as a euphemism for psychological warfare. In the post-Second World War moment, as the U.S. wanted to solidify itself as the single hegemon in the world. I make the people listen, Boogie Town, mimic. I make the people listen, Boogie Town, mimic.
We got finance, action, and scores of sport. Politics, new fashion, and war reports. Entertainment, when we come to perform, watch.
Down the hill is weatherman in the biz on Stormwatch.
Triclops, media, record tape, or TV. Net, radio, CD, or DVD. I'm a science. And this is why Babu is in scratch and keeping time.
The Secure DC Omnibus Bill is the latest attempt by DC's local government to impose law and order while ignoring the root issues that lead to street-level crime and advancing the war against the black working class. After passing unanimously by the DC Council's Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety, the new crime bill was voted on and unanimously passed on February 6, 2024 by the full council. Today, March 5th, the DC Council will hold a final vote on the hyper-repressive so-called Secure DC Omnibus Crime Bill. Pan-African Community Action contends that black people in the U.S. are a domestic colony, an internal colony that is enforced by a massive police presence meant to control and keep us exploited for our labor and other human resources. Consequently, this bill will impose more state surveillance, grant police in the state more authority to target, harass, and brutalize black residents, and expand the police occupation of the ghettos of black people in DC. The reforms proposed in the Secure DC bill cannot replace the need to build community-led, people's-centered power. PACA understands that real and permanent solutions to systemic inequities and root issues are achieved by shifting power into the hands of an organized African/black working class. Turn out 10 a.m. today to pack the room at the Wilson Building at 1350 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest. Add to the space the call for decolonization and self-determination. To learn more about PACA's positions and analysis, go on the web to pacapower.org/no-DC-crime-bill. That's pacapower.org/no-DC-crime-bill.
Listening to Voices with Vision, the show that's not for the politically faint of heart on your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Netfa in the virtual studio with Brother Craig. From February 12th to the 14th, 2024, was the second international meeting of theoretical publications of left parties and movements that took place in Havana, Cuba. The conference called for unity, the fight for peace, and the people's solidarity against imperialist aggression. The event brought together 100 intellectuals, personalities, thinkers, and academics from 37 countries, together with their Cuban colleagues, to debate the current challenges faced by progressive forces and agree on common strategies of action against the resurgence of fascism and the violent capitalist onslaught. Two of the people that went, we are privileged to talk to today, Erica Keynes, the Coordinating Committee Vice Chair of the Black Alliance for Peace. Erica serves as the co-coordinator of the Black Alliance for Peace's Haiti Americas team and leads as the coordinator of the BAP Baltimore Citywide Alliance. Erica is a member of the Black Working Class-centered Ujima People's Progress Party in Maryland, and founder of Liberation Through Reading, and co-editor of the African revolutionary blog Hood Communist. Also with Hood Communist is Onyesonwu Chitoye, an organizer with the All-African People's Revolutionary Party and the All-African Women's Revolutionary Union, and like I said, an editor with Hood Communist, and a member of the National Coordinating Committee for the Venta Ramos Brigade, the oldest Cuban solidarity delegation in the United States. Welcome to you both back to Voice of Blue Vision. I think this might be the first time we had you on at the same time. Is that right? Yeah. All right now. And we know y'all was partners in crime the whole time, but we just, for some reason, whatever the situation called for, you've been on at different times. So it's good to have you both on at the same time. So you both recently returned from the second international meeting of the theoretical publications of left parties and movements in Cuba, and you were invited as Hood Communists in your capacity as representatives of the Hood Communist publication. So Onye and Erica, I gave, you heard my context, my little intro context about what this conference is. Before we get into some other stuff, why the two of you, maybe starting with you, Onye, can you give us your firsthand lay of the land, how the conference was, what was it like, who was there, that kind of thing, your impressions?
Yeah, of course. It was held in a really beautiful conference space in Havana. There were delegates, I believe, from 32 countries. So like folks from Vietnam, China, Russia, Panama, ZANU-PF was there, which was very exciting. There was also a very strong Palestinian delegation made up of Palestinian students who were attending the Latin American School of Medicine, and also like an editor with Al-Hadaf, which is like a Marxist-Leninist Palestinian paper, and then an editor with Resumen, a woman. And so they were like a force.
Resumen. That's, yeah. Gabriela.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, that's, yeah, my comrade.
A force in the space. And there were also delegates, of course, from the United States, like Cuba C and the Socialist Workers Party. We talked a long time with this comrade from Ireland. And so it was like many, many, many different languages in the space. And they had like those headsets that allowed us to communicate with each other. But of course, there was a delay. The conference was organized by the Communist Party of Cuba and the youth wing of the Communist Party of Cuba. And it was separated into like, I believe, like four sessions as well as like workshops, with each session around a specific topic. And then you could like sign up to give your remarks. One thing, and you know this because you organize Cuba SAW delegations, even sometimes they don't be giving you the details.
Right. Until it's time to go. It's like, where are we going now? What are we doing?
So that's what we did. We were like, okay, what's happening? Okay. And then we like made a plan. We wrote our statements collectively. We like figured out who was going to say what. We had to like very much like figure it out on the fly. And that was actually really rewarding to be able to work together like that, because like, collective writing is usually like a very protracted process. We were able to like come together very quickly, unite, and figure out a plan.
Right. And just to say, Erica, you go too, but just to give a word in until that goes, is people don't realize, one, when you're trying to move a whole bunch of people like this, things don't always go as planned. You gotta adapt. Cubans are good at doing it, but anybody doing it, sometimes that happens. If you're one of those people that's just being kind of herded with everybody else, you're like, what I gotta do? And then also they're dealing with the blockade and limited resources, all kinds of stuff. So, but it makes it work. It can appear like they're disorganized, but actually, on the contrary, they're very organized.
Exactly.
Very organized. This was my first experience like this in a sort of space where it was all of these different countries coming together. One of the things I think was also important is that there was a resolution around Palestine That all of these, all of the attendees kind of came to at the end of it. So that was really good. And that statement is also on hoodcommunist.org if folks want to check it out. But I think it was really rewarding. I also had a chance to gift books while I was in Cuba through Liberation Through Reading. So we got to have a little downtime and seeing the neighborhoods and things like that, and doing those kind of important exchanges because, you know, given with the blockade, Cuba's in a very particular special period right now. And it's really important that we advocate to end the blockade first and foremost and then get Cuba off the terrorist list. But we were able to still be amongst Cubans. And I think that was really a really good aspect of the trip because usually these delegations are very work centered. But we did have a chance to be in a community and be around different organizers who organized amongst Cuba.
Yeah, welcome to Voice with Vision. I wanted to start off maybe this conversation talking about propaganda. You know, the word propaganda, I know it's going to come up during this discussion. And in fact, one of your presentations at this meeting is titled A Strategic Proposal to Battle Media Propaganda. So, you know, to the layperson growing up in the United States society, this word propaganda usually means like some form of lies, you know, cooked up by communists to trick and confuse people. What do you mean when you talk about propaganda, and where do we see this media propaganda, and, you know, how is this propaganda being used?
My understanding of the term propaganda is that it's a neutral term. So it is dependent on who's using it, right? So how we understand propaganda and the use of it is strategically much different than imperialist propaganda. For instance, if we look at what's happening with Palestine and the use of capitalist propaganda around the issue of Palestinian resistance and in Palestine, the sovereignty and self-determination of the Palestinian people, that is distinctly different from the way that we would use Hood Communists as a media entity to sort of spread the truth objectively about what's happening, the historic truth, lay out a history and such. So we do understand that there's a drastic difference in the use of propaganda depending on who's using it and the objective to what they will use it for. Oh yeah, I don't know if you want to add more.
Yeah, I think that the boogeyman of propaganda you just mentioned that we most commonly hear in the US is about like supposed communist propaganda. But the reality situation is that we are the most propagandized population on the face of the planet. And the propaganda we're getting is like capitalist, imperialist, white supremacist, purely ruling class propaganda, inundated in all forms of media, all the shows we watch, all the media we consume is like pushing a very anti-social, anti-human, anti-life line that we don't even recognize because we're swimming in it all the time. And so when we talk about revolutionary propaganda, it's a tactic to oppose this, to counter this, to like point out to people what nonsense this is, how like antisocial this is, and how we need something different. So the argument of propaganda is communist, but the actual reality of propaganda that we're living under is capitalist, is ruling class driven.
Yeah. I just wanted to add to Onye's point. I think we even referenced that when Maurice Bishop came to the U.S., one of the first things they noted is that the U.S. is like, we are the most propagandized population because it's everywhere and it's intentional. It's how they are able to utilize their messaging in order to spread their hegemony. So I think it's really useful. I also want to note, because I always do, Onye wrote a fantastic piece about how you can strategically combat that sort of propaganda. And I think that is what's necessary in terms of how we're understanding it, because it is strategically organized. And in order to combat it, we would need to be organized as well.
Well, that goes into my next question. I was going to ask that because not only, you know, what you all just said, also Onye mentioned the bombardment. And so it's not only strategically organized, but they just every platform and it's kind of overwhelm us. But so what are some of the, you know, solutions that you recommend, given that we don't really have the loudest megaphone and all that? What should we be doing?
What we always like to say is that superior organization will always overpower superior force and superior resources. What we're missing now in terms of our attempts to combat media propaganda is a level of organization to actually carry out a collective strategy across the anti-imperialist movement, across the socialist movement. What's happening now is that we tend to react. Like, they come out with like some new lie, some new whopper, and we're like, that's not true. And we're like constantly scrambling, you know, to like point out the contradictions, to identify the lies. And we're also doing it on a very like siloed basis. Like, it might happen with maybe like a handful of organizations or one organization, but it's constantly reactive and it's constantly siloed. What actually needs to happen is cross movement, cross tendency, cross border coordination around these campaigns. And an example we gave during the conference was in when the July 11th protests happened in Cuba in 2020, which we know was because of the maximum pressure campaign applied by the Trump administration that made conditions, exacerbated conditions for Cuban people, caused great suffering, which was the intent. But the narrative about those protests pushed in the US media was that it was about so-called anti-blackness in Cuba. The Cuban revolution is inherently racist towards Africans, and the Africans don't want socialism anymore, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you saw like this pylon start to start in the US, particularly among petty bourgeois people like academics talking about anti-blackness in Cuba, getting their Afro-pessimist analysis on. And there was this moment where it seemed it was gonna take over the discourse. And then you saw like a wave of pushback that came from the Black Lives Matter movement, that came from the Black Alliance for Peace, that came from the APRP, that came from Hood Communists, like that came from this wave of African organizations who in the past had participated in Cuba Solidarity delegations and Cuba Solidarity work and who were able to coordinate to shut it down. Like, Black Lives Matter has a lot of justified criticisms, but when they put out that statement saying, if you support Africans in Cuba and the blockade, it was like mic drop. And that's the kind of coordination we need.
Yeah, and the coordination and the fact that truth can also dispel a whole bunch of lies all the time. It's always much more compelling to people when they see the truth juxtaposed to falsehoods.
And one of the things discussed also was, as Onye was noting, that it was cross-tendency, it was a multitude of different organizations. But we did discuss, when we were in Cuba, unity as the main strategic weapon and utilizing unity and asking the questions, well, how do we come to that position to where we can utilize it strategically? So there was a lot of emphasis on principles that unite us so that we can combat this propaganda.
Yeah, and you know, y'all been answering what I guess would have been my next question, but maybe we can expand on it. And that is this need for a unified left movement. You know, at this conference, at this meeting, there were representatives from many different countries. We're talking about unity right now. There is this notion sometimes that here in the United States, we should just be concerned with what's going on domestically in the United States and not necessarily link it with what's going on elsewhere. So can you expand on that a little bit? You know, what is this need for a what you call a unified left movement, and what would be the significance, the power behind that?
I think one thing, first of all, the ruling class has been like a really successful form of ruling class propaganda in the United States is the successful convincing of people that so-called domestic issues are completely separated from international issues. The US is like the most malignant empire on the face of the planet. It has its tentacles spread across the entire world. It is constantly involved in destabilizing movements and exploiting nations and invasions and interventions. But meanwhile, the people living in the US are so separated from that reality, not because they're bad people, but because they've been intentionally misdirected and confused. And so a really important task of anti-imperialist revolutionaries, of African revolutionaries in the US, is to show people the direct connections between what the conditions we're experiencing domestically and what's happening around the world. I think campaigns that point to, for example, the training of US police forces by the Israeli Defense Force, the training of military and police forces in Africa by the Department of Defense, by AFRICOM, and then also the surplus military equipment being given to police forces in the US are examples of things that we can explain to people that show the direct connections between the police terrorism we experience in our neighborhoods and the police and military terrorism supported by the US all around the world. We have to illuminate for people these connections, show them that it's not just about domestic versus international, that it's all interconnected, that we have a responsibility to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would argue, again, to Onye's point, it is intentional to separate into silo. I mean, that is the basis of organizing within the U.S. So I would say unity, international unity is necessary, but also domestically, the left is kind of a bit of a mess, primarily because of the same kind of siloed objectives, as opposed to understanding things in a bigger sense, emphasizing the base of the superstructure and things like that. So I think that the left in itself, it has the inability to have an international perspective because of the way the left is kind of disorganized here. But yeah, I do think that organizations like the AAPRP and then us in the Black Lives for Peace do a lot of great work in connecting the domestic with the global and understanding both as counterparts. To Onye's point, the weapons that are used in the in AFRICOM or SOUTHCOM or even the Indo-Pacific Command, the surplus of that comes back into the 1033 program, that comes back into our neighborhoods. So these are our immediate concerns. And also to the extent what's happening in Haiti, we're hearing all of this sort of rise in gangs and gang crime, et cetera, et cetera. We can recognize that here is the rise in crime. Both narratives are pushing for occupation of our communities. So in that sense, we can understand that imperialism is both a mechanism, not just globally, but here domestically. And that is the primary contradiction that unites us. And I think that that needs to be the focus. But to the point of the question of propaganda, that is the main issue that has seemed to sort of disillusion people from understanding these connections.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to put in there, you mentioned the 1033 program. Just for those who may not know, it's the program that authorizes the Department of Defense to dispense its excess surplus equipment to local police departments domestically in the United States. And but I wanted to ask, there's another issue that the three of you, actually it was also Musa, but he couldn't make it with us today. But another issue that you presented at the meeting was the importance of the youth and winning the battle for their minds. So give us your perspectives on, particularly around historically Black colleges and universities or HBCUs, where so many of us, our students, get their education. What is the situation and what are the possibilities?
We leaned a lot on the work that the BAP Mid-Atlantic, the Black Alliance for Peace Mid-Atlantic, had published in Hung Communist around the collusion between HBCUs and the states. We had written that at the time of the issue at Howard with the housing conditions. And then we had also seen that it was happening at the AUC, which is Spelman, Morehouse, Clark, Atlanta. It was also happening in HBCUs in North Carolina. And it just seemed to be a streamline. And as we dug deeper, we found these sort of connections to the state. So we also referenced Kwame Ture and his conversations around Howard University and how he talked about Howard always being two Howards, right? There's always been a battle and a struggle around liberation and such, but because Howard is an institution, exists as an institution that favors the state or is beholden to the state. So these kind of struggles have always existed among the youth in these spaces. And what we're seeing now is maybe a resurgence of that sort of struggle. But then we're also, again, combating a particular type of propaganda that is issued out of those same institutions that are finding their way onto social media and becoming the range of debate for people who are deciding to join organizations and get involved. So they're being swayed by sort of postmodernist conceptions of how to understand the world and how to understand their material conditions. And they're being moved away from a particular material understanding or dialectical understanding, because those terms are sort of relegated to a particular framework or ideology that the institutions are against. So as such, you get a particular type of Black student that comes out of HBCUs that you can see now is the struggle, is the fight. And what we pushed and what we argued in our statement is that we can't concede these particular kind of spaces. Someone in another Western nation made a good statement around TikTok, very much in depth. So we can see that this is something that's not just affecting us here. Like, how do we actually combat that? Or how do we not concede to that? Or how do we enter that space and make it useful? Because that's something that I think the entire Western world is dealing with because of the mechanism of the use of these spaces that we do not own, and we don't have any political power to really sway it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not just the Western world. Like, that's one of the things that really stood out to me from the conference was the discussion of the phenomenon of like color revolutions, of movements that on the surface, particularly on social media, pretend to be grassroots, but are really like driven by imperialism. And something that delegates like from like Vietnam, from Russia, from Panama were talking about was how like youth are often the driving force of these movements that are mobilized from like TikTok, from Twitter, from whatnot. And they have like the energy, the enthusiasm, the momentum to like take to the streets. But because they don't have like that political development yet, that political consciousness built up yet, they are very easily weaponized against the socialist and anti-imperialist projects of their nations. Like, I think we've seen that in place after place after place. And so there was like the discussion of the need for like really intense and systematic political development of like cadre training, of like education for youth so that they can be mobilized in support of revolution instead of against revolution. But just recognizing that it's a global problem that we're currently facing with the enemy's capture of social media.
Can you do me a favor? For other people who may not be familiar with the term color revolution, can you give us a little quick primer on that one?
A really good recent example was the so-called Maidan Revolution in Ukraine that happened in 2014 when it was presented in Western media. It was presented as like a people's movement against like a Russian puppet dictator, and they like successfully pushed him out. And that's how like, you know, the US media was talking about it, US politicians were talking about it, the State Department was talking about it. But when you actually saw what was happening on the ground, and this tends to be the case in most places where color revolutions happen, the forces were right wing, in some cases extreme right wing, fascist, who were being backed by Western imperialism, backed by NATO, got the batteries in their back from the United States. And so their intent was to destabilize Ukraine, to push out a government that was hostile to US interests, and to replace that government with one that could be controlled externally. And that's essentially what color revolutions do. They present themselves as people's movements, but they are actually attempts of imperialism to destabilize nations resisting imperialism.
I wanted to talk about another aspect that you presented on there at the conference, and that is the importance of what you describe as the work of defending the historical memory of revolutionary struggle. What is it that you're referring to there? Why is that important to do?
So that was the remarks that Musa read, but we were talking about the legacy of anti-imperialist, revolutionary socialist, anti-colonial struggle that belongs to the masses of African people, that belongs to the masses of colonized people around the world, that is very often, especially recently, co-opted by our enemy, that we have to remember our victories, we have to remember our strategies, we have to remember who we're actually fighting against and what we're actually fighting for, and not allow them to twist that memory. Like, this is what we were talking about, how we can find strength and clarity and a guide for the future by actually studying our revolutionary past.
I was just going to say, I would also add the recent comments from Kamala on the bridge, and just the image of that and how people are talking about it being the most powerful image because of the sort of historical significance of that bridge. But then again, sort of removing the historical and political significance of that bridge to then use it as a way to highlight this new Black woman vice president and, you know, all of these particular identities that she holds without really taking into account what she went to go say for a 6-week sort of humanitarian ceasefire as they are encouraging the ongoing genocide and funding it and providing the weapons for the ongoing genocide of Palestinians.
And, you know, we're in this campaign and election season in the United States. And, you know, in the recent past, we saw record-breaking numbers of Africans and, you know, artists, activists, organizers, all kinds of people who identify themselves as part of the left supporting the candidacy in the presidency of Barack Obama. So, you know, what do you think is the lesson of his presidency, the role that he played, and particularly in light of what you're bringing up now, the prospects in a sense of like an aging Biden could be replaced by Kamala Harris, or they could even pull Michelle Obama out the hat, you know, at the Democratic convention, and then the U.S. electorate would then be looking at, you know, a viable woman of color presidential candidate. You know, what's your take on that in terms of, you know, the lessons and our historical, what do we call it, our historical memory of this revolutionary struggle?
Well, I think our people have been, the reason why someone like Barack Obama was able to successfully be held up as some kind of fulfillment of the liberation struggle of our people is because we have been misdirected about what the purpose of that liberation struggle was. Our ancestors were made into American citizens by force. It was never what we were fighting for. We were fighting for independence. We were fighting for self-determination. We were fighting for the right to exist and live as African people. And assimilation by force into the American project was not part of the plan for a lot of us. And so an African being elevated to that position, being the face of imperialism, being the face of domestic oppression of African people, could only have been celebrated as a victory by successfully indoctrinating and confusing our people. And Kamala Harris, Michelle Obama, is just going to be another representation of that same phenomenon of confusion. I feel like they keep trying to sell us African faces in high places as somehow a collective win for all of us. And over and over and over again, they sell us out. They align with the genocidal imperialist machine. Another example I'm thinking of is the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas Greenfield, who has vetoed three different ceasefire resolutions, who is literally the international face of the U.S. backing of Israel's genocide in Palestine. And Susan Rice, Colin Powell, so many of them.
And the young woman who's now on the Supreme Court.
Oh my God, Ketanji Brown Jackson or whatnot. There's so many of them, and they don't represent us. They're not for us. They are cogs in a machine that is trying to destroy us, trying to destroy Africa, trying to dominate the world. And so our people have to remember what our ancestors were actually fighting for, what liberation actually means. Us at the top of an empire is not liberation.
Right. And I think that was one of the things that was also pushed strongly, as you noted in the top of the interview, about the battle of the ideas and also the importance of historical memory. To Onye's point, this could only have occurred through a successful indoctrination, because when we talk about reasserting or returning to that Black radical tradition, we're talking about that era or that time where radicals fought for self-determination. And we've seen that what Obama has been able to do, to Glenn Ford's credit, of calling this man the highest level of counterinsurgency, we have seen that he has been able to sort of misdirect a people who was staunchly inherently anti-war to being on the opposite side of that, to being a proponent of it, to being the faces of it now. But we have also Lord Austin, you could have mentioned as well. And this is just a continuation of it. And what I think is important, and what was highlighted then at that conference, is that the need to dispel these ideas of these seats at the table. I mean, Kwame Ture has mentioned this 30 years ago even, right? We always had these faces in these places. That is not the issue. The issues that they take up these spaces as a Black misleadership class, and they are not for us, and they have never been, and they're in opposition to any of the liberation that we're trying to obtain. And I think that to politically educate people is really important in this time, in this moment, so that we can have that return to that sort of Black radical tradition, but also a clarity of who exactly the enemy is.
Well, thank you so much, the two of you. We were speaking with Erica Keynes and Onyesonwu Chetoye, who are both with Hood Communists. They're editors of Hood Communists and so much more, to organizers. Thank you for being on Voices with Vision. Everyone should check out, make sure you go to hoodcommunist.org, in particular, the three of them who were representing at this had the delegation for Hood Communists in Cuba. Read Hood Communist Talks Media and Revolution in Cuba, and they give an introduction, and then also they have the links to each of their presentations that they gave there at the conference. Thank you for being on Voice of Vision.
Thank you for having us.
If you are a person who has listened to us and is now interested in going to Cuba, just want to plug the 52nd contingent of the Vencemos Brigade departing to Cuba, to Guantanamo in the Eastern Province, July 17th to July 30th. If you want to come with us, we're trying to bring 125 people from the United States. Visit vbforcuba.com and apply. Please join us.
Thank you.
Brings us to a conclusion. This show featured the song Proper Propaganda by Dilated Peoples, the voices of Jamil Alameen, formerly known as H-Rap Brown, and Malcolm X, Marawi Garima, Asata Shakur, Jared Ball of I Mix What I Like, and Black Power Media. Thank you for listening. Remember to tune in to Voice with Vision every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and follow and like Voices with Vision on Facebook.
And I'm on my way to the Wilson building right now. Remember, you can listen and subscribe to Voices with Vision as a podcast on Google Podcasts or iTunes or Player FM. Just search for Voices with Vision, WPFW. Keep it here for Crossroads with Roach Brown and Nkechi Taif, and make an effort to stay politically educated, organized, and committed to the fight for the liberation of your people, or
fall back.
It goes F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom. We are L-I-B-R-B-G. We live F-R-E or D-I-E. We lace music with code, just something to bring us closer. Kick true, the young black youth like we're supposed to. No swine in our rovers or Louis Vuitton holsters. We in the trench with young 50 cents and street soldiers. The ones they ain't lock up and send the foreign waters to fight for something they ain't got in their own borders. It's us, the free unit, they ain't holding us back. We score the soundtrack to this movement. Y'all just rap, brat, black on black and clap about that. State trooper shot, Miss Everly's boy in the back, Miss Rogers boy in the back. While we ain't firing back, the boys is gone and they ain't coming back. We gotta go back, San Cole for right and exact. It's the red, green, and the black, black, black. It go
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K.
Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW on its 47th birthday. It is such an exciting day. We ask you to go to the phone as WPFW celebrates SNCC and Dore Ladner and so much more. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
Taking Action offers listeners current information about protecting our schools and communities by interviewing leaders in public housing development and educators. We share strategies to stand up for social justice, providing a voice for the homeless and those fighting against gentrification in our city, in addition to building our power as a community by supporting local businesses and holding government officials accountable for their actions. Taking Action is produced by Empower DC. Listen every Tuesday on 89.3 FM at 1 p.m. Also available on iTunes Podcast and Google Play Music. On your station for jazz and justice, WPFW, Washington.
The WPFW Local Station Board invites you to attend our town hall meeting Saturday, March 16th at the New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., from noon until 2:30 p.m. Our theme is WPFW, Generations Moving Forward in Unity. Listeners and supporters of all ages are welcome. Young listeners are especially encouraged to attend. We want to hear from you concerning community needs, shaping future broadcasting, and more. Listeners can also take this opportunity to bid farewell to the station's general manager, Jerry Paris, who is retiring after 10 years of service. Connect with WPFW as we plan to move forward together in unity. If unable to attend in person, a Zoom link will be posted on the website. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Celebrating 20 years, the New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project, brings the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora to the DMV at the AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 15 to the 28th. The festival features 26 films from 16 countries, including 3 years premieres and discussions with filmmakers. Explore the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa at the 2024 New African Film Festival. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver. Or call 301-495-6700. 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden, the proprietor of Robin's Place,